tonight. We're here to continue with Dave H.
Yes.
Halfway through.
Week six, right?
I better get going, right. I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. I'm doing this, and I actually listened to the recordings, and I feel like I'm talking really fast, and man, I'm not. It's horrifying. So my thing is, the most important thing I find in recovery is passing it on, sponsorship, and I'm fortunate, and through sponsorship, my experience in AA, my recovery has just grown immensely, and I feel so fortunate. And like anything in recovery, once you find something, you want everybody to have it. So I really push everyone to be a sponsor and it doesn't happen through osmosis. You have to learn about the big book, and then I Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and Alcoholics Anonymous comes of age. And the more we learn, the more we have to talk about and share and transmit. And so I get to work with a lot of guys, and it's usually wonderful, this week was not, this week was not wonderful at all. It started with our good friend Krishna, who I think you know, Laura, from the Dawn Patrol, who's a sweetheart of a guy. 2 weeks ago, because we're getting ready to read more about alcoholism, and suddenly the thought occurred to me. 2 weeks ago, we're playing golf, and this guy's a lovely gentleman, an Indian guy, and couldn't be sweeter, and he's had a lot of relapses. You talk about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. His last relapse, he was on a flight to India. He was drinking. When he came out of his blackout, he was handcuffed to a wheelchair in customs. They turned him around and sent him back to the U.S., So 2 weeks ago, we met his daughter. We were playing golf at Rutgers. His daughter goes to Rutgers. And he has her come meet us, introduces us to his daughter. He's very proud, his sober friends, blah, blah, blah. They have lunch. We tee off. And then walking down the first fairway, Krishna says, recovery in AA is so wonderful. A year ago, my daughter wouldn't speak to me. And now here we are having lunch together and introducing her to my AA friends. And I love AA. I love AA. And so Tuesday this week, I get a call from his daughter saying, my mom's in India. I couldn't get my dad, so I got a ride home from Rutgers. Someone gave her a ride. And I found my dad unresponsive on the couch, vodka bottles everywhere. And so I said, he's alive, right? And he was. So I said, just leave him a note, call a sponsor, let him know he broke your heart, And so I text him, I called him, nothing. Thursday I get a call from his wife from India, and she says, I've gotten 3 phone calls this morning already, 2 from our neighbors, 1 from the Plainfield Police Department. He must be trying to get more vodka because the neighbors say he's driven all over their lawns, hit their house, hit their cars, and the police say he hit a bunch of cars on the streets of Plainfield and took down a traffic signal, And if you knew the guy, he's just shocking, right? Shocking, shocking, And this is after how wonderful, it's just suddenly the thought. And so when I saw him in the detox, he goes, I was in the detox he was in. I got him in the detox. I was there Friday night. And he said, I was just cutting branches, and I thought I'd get a bottle of vodka. And then that's the happy story. The sad story is a wonderful young man who sat in the back row over there overdosed and passed away, Michael R. And he was doing great. He was sponsoring Alex, who's sitting in the back there right now, reading the big book with him. Doing great, and there's always something, and I try to figure it out. The one thing is, I'm a big man. When you come in, I was taught in this room, as you all know, that it's men with the men, women with the women, and even I love the highly educated guys who think think, well, we're just friends, you know, and we're not friends. You know, we don't want to be friends. I love when they actually say that with a straight face. And I said to him, you actually went to Yale, didn't you? You know, I know I only went to Glassboro State, but I'm not that stupid. There's a thing with a woman, and I'm not going to go into it because it will really get me going. And the woman called me today saying, I hope you're not blaming me and all that. And I said, I really have nothing to say. And she said, look, it's men with the men. This is very, very, very serious. And I said, it's men with the men. We all want to talk to girls. And if girls talk to us, we're going to talk to them. You know, and same thing. I think the women have the same thing. We're all uncomfortable when we get here. So, you know, but one thing she said, but aren't we human? And that really hit me. And I said, well, the answer is, yeah, we are human. That's the problem. You know, but the other thing, you know, and then I said, wait a minute, let me ask you a question. I said, do you think you're the same level of alcoholic that Michael was? You know, do you think your story is as bad as Michael's? And she's, no, absolutely not, obviously. And that's your lesson then. You have no idea. You were in the deep end of the pool and you didn't know it, you know. So it's a scale of how far down the scale we've gone, you know. They were two different scales. There was, you know, she's here for the group therapy and he was here to save his life. And this is serious stuff and it's a sad, 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 sad thing. And, you know, we have to take it. You know, we're here to save our lives. You know, we're here to save our lives. We're not here to, get a date or many of the other things. So, and I'll weave this into our thing. So we're on, almost done with There Is a Solution. We're on page 26. We're getting ready to talk about Roland Hazard, who is a very important component in the formation of 12-step recovery. He brought Bill Wilson the answer, you know, or he brought it to Abby Thatcher brought it to Bill Wilson. But again, I like to look at the book. When I read the book, I look at it from the standpoint of it's brand new, there's no AA, let's read it and really try to, instead of my sponsor explain, you know, really try to absorb this experience through reading it and identifying with it. And the last thing I'll say before I start reading is we can read this all we want, and I love to dissect it. I love every word in the big book, you know, and I love, but you get nothing unless you take the actions, which took me a long time, but the more, like I said, through sponsorship, through the step process, going through it and sharing with the man your fifth step and surrendering or trying to come to know a God, just to know your God, not anybody else's God, but then to share a fifth step with somebody and then to sit down and make those face-to-face amends and try to right the wrongs we've done and get our life clean again. That's great and you feel great, but boy, when you take your first person through the steps, when you sit and you read the big book, it's horrifying because as you start to do it, and I was talking to somebody, I think he's out in the... I was talking to somebody about it today. Because as you start to do it, you say, oh my God, I wasn't paying attention. I didn't learn anything. I don't know enough, you know. And that really motivates you to start reading Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And once you're like, oh my God, I don't know anything, you know, or I'm not doing it. And that's not true, but you feel that way. It's really not true, but you sure feel like I'm not worthy of doing this. And none of us are. The only way we get worthy is by making a lot of mistakes, unfortunately. So... I was listening to Chris S., who I love. I think he's the greatest in the world. And he was talking about people who relapse with 5 years or 10 years. And he says it's always the same thing. They weren't going to meetings. They weren't practicing spiritual principles. They weren't blah, blah, blah. And everyone he said, I said, well, if you're sponsoring guys, you got to keep going to meetings. You got to keep, you know, because you have to lead by example. You have to, you don't tell people what to do. You show them what to do. And I, so that's just my strong feeling is if you are working with others and you know you are constantly involved and you have to do what you were taught to so you can tell other people. You can't ask somebody to do what you haven't done. That's the bottom line. So okay, I'm gonna skip around a little bit because as you can see, I'm so slow. We got to speed it up a little bit. So Roland Hazard is it comes from a very, very wealthy family. The family doesn't know what to do with them. Again, there's no AA. They send them to live with Carl Jung, and that's for you young people. That's like sending your kid to live with Tony Robbins or Dr. Phil or somebody like that for a year. You know, it's very expensive. You know, Carl Jung was one of the main thinkers in psychology, So anyway, it says a certain American businessman had good ability, or good sense, high character, but for years floundered from one detox to another, and rehab. He consulted the best known counselors in these places, and then had gone to Europe, placing himself under the care of Carl Jung, who prescribed for him. The experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. So, you know, when you're with Carl Jung, it's going to be a lot like the rehabs where they tell you about your triggers and a lot of things that really have nothing to do with our soul sickness, you know. But this was their best thinking at the time. Above all, though, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of his inner workings and his hidden springs, I think that's the original word for triggers, that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. And as the story goes, I've heard two stories. I heard he got drunk before he even got to the ship. I've heard he got drunk when he got back to the States. And more baffling, he could not give himself a satisfactory explanation for the fall. So he went right back to Carl Jung, whom he did admire, and asked him point blank, "What's wrong with me?" You know, he wished above all things to regain self-control. And that's all we thought it was back then. He had not met Silkworth. He had not met, you know, self-control, willpower. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to his other problems, but he had no control over alcohol. Why was this? So he begged the doctor, you know, tell me the truth. Don't. And in the doctor's opinion, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society. And he would have to, because he could afford it. The doctor said, hire a bodyguard and have this guy walk around with you all the time. And it says, but this man is, Lizza is a free man. He can go anywhere he wants. He doesn't need a bodyguard. And they abbreviate it. But it says here, some of our alcoholic readers may think that they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation this Roland had with the doctor. He said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, which was pretty revolutionary back then. I've never seen a single case recover like you. And our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. But he said, is there no exception? So this guy, Roland Hazard, wasn't giving up. He's begging him. He's asking him if there's an exception. And the doctor said, yes, there are exceptions. They've been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, an alcoholic has what's called a vital spiritual experience. To me, these occurrences are a phenomenon. They appear in the nature of a huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. And this is a great line. And this is what we're trying to get when we work, you know, for the newcomer. We're trying to change all your ideas, your emotions, your attitudes, I would say your beliefs, I would say your priorities. If I was writing the big book, a couple more things. But it says, which were once the guiding forces of your lives, and these men, and they're suddenly cast out to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. So we, and the book talks about this over and over. We want to get everything you think out, and everything we've learned in, because what we've learned we know makes us feel better. We know what you're thinking. We've thought what you thought. We've gotten what you're getting, and we don't want you to get it anymore. We want you to get what we get, you know. So we ask you to do the things that we did, you know, as, if that makes sense. So with many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been successful with the alcoholic of your description. Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member, which I was not a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctor telling him that while his religious convictions were good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. Here was a terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which we've already told you made him a free man. So the bottom line is Roland Hazard went back to America believing in this, and he got involved with the Oxford Group, you know, and with a vigor, you know, with a real vigor. And then he in turn bailed out Ebbie Thatcher, and Ebbie Thatcher went to Bill Wilson. So the idea of God and the spiritual experience came from Carl Jung, you know, through Roland Hazard to Ebbie Thatcher to Bill Wilson. The idea of the mental obsession and the physical craving, which we've really the first part of this chapter talks about, came from Silkworth, and the practical program of action which Roland Hazard brought to him was the program of the Oxford Group. So this is how it all comes together. It says, we in turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of a drowning man. And in a lot of big book studies, we try to turn statements into questions, and that's a question is, do you have the desperation of a drowning man? And hopefully you do. What at first seemed a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And that's a wonderful thing when you realize, you know, hopefully you realize that, and that's a very, very comforting thing. A new life has been given to us, if you prefer, a design for living that really works. It says here, we think it is no concern of ours what religious bodies, and this is very freeing again if you're reading this by yourself. We don't care what your religious body or members are, identify themselves with as individuals. This is an entirely personal affair, which each one decides in light of his past associations. So we're not going to tell you what church to go to. Not all of us join religious bodies, but most of us favor such memberships. And there's two things I always talk about doing in life. One is going back to church, and the other one is yoga. It didn't happen today, and tomorrow's not looking too good either. Although, I would say we're in church right now. And I'll do some stretching after the meeting. In the following chapter, there appears to be an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it. Then a chapter addressed to the agnostic. Many of us were once in that class. Clear-cut directions are given showing how we, the first 100 people, have recovered, followed by 42 personal experiences. And then they go on to explain to this guy who's reading the book by himself. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own or her own language, from their own experience and point of view, the way they established their relationship with God. And that's what this is all about. It has very little to do with our drinking. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what actually happened in their lives. We hope, you know, so these people talk about things today that are pretty distasteful, but we all understand them, you know. Again, the book's coming out and people are talking about really bad behavior, so it says, we hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages and believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our bad stuff or problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So, okay, that's the end of there is a solution, and they really didn't give us much about the solution. They just told us there is a solution, you know, and they explained it slightly, mostly that it's God, but they are now going to tell us more. We're really still on the first step here. You know, I forget I should know this stuff. Real smart people do know it, but, you know, I forget. It's like the first 56 pages or something like that are on the first step. For the most part, because that really is the foundation of our program. They say if you're having trouble with the third step or the fourth step or the ninth step, you know, it's a first step problem. You know, if you truly know how screwed you are, how much trouble you're in, if you can clearly see how alcohol is destroying your life and those around you, you're willing to do anything. One of these guys in the back said they were going to get naked and do something. I asked them not to use those words. I said I'd go to Broad Street and roll a watermelon up Broad Street if that was going to get me sober. Let's keep our clothes on. But I appreciate it. So more about alcoholism. So it says most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics, and that's an important word, real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. And if you can walk in this room and realize that you're 100% like everybody else in this room, based on sex, age, religion, race, we are all exactly the same, you know. That is the biggest gift you can get. When you realize we're all one in this room, you can start to get better. It took me a long time. I was always smarter than you guys. Just terminal uniqueness, and you see it, and you try to suppress it in people, but it's a tough one. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. And I wonder if that's what Krishna was thinking when he was cutting the branches. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And that's a great question. The persistence of this is an illusion we all have. And we have it over and over and over and over and over. And that's many of it pursued to the gates of insanity or death. And we are insane. You know, that's our insanity has to do with our relationship with drugs and alcohol. And we do it over. We're talking about methamphetamine. I mean, we just keep doing it over and over, thinking that, I don't know what we're thinking. We learned that this is the first step. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we, the first 100 people, were alcoholics. This is what we had to do. We learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics, and that's what they all did. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we're like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's a really important thing. We've lost the ability to control our drinking. That's when you tell a newcomer that, I don't think they really understand that. I understand it today, but I couldn't see it back then. I couldn't see. I thought I could control my drinking if I wanted to. But if I could, I wouldn't need to be here with you guys. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. Ever is in italics. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by less control, which led in time to pitiful and this is a great description, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I think we all know that feeling, right? We've all woken up saying, oh my God, I did it again, and the feeling of being pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized. One thing is, too, is I quit drinking for a long time, as a number of us did, right? And when I started drinking again, it was worse. I mean, it was a lot worse. And I say to myself, I wonder, it probably would have been better if I just kept drinking the whole time. You know, I could have never gotten to here, you know, because, I mean, you're so excited to drink again, right? That you go, man, you go. You know, I mean, my man Krishna, he went. Yeah. And, yeah, that's why you don't want me as a sponsor. You make a mistake, man, I'm throwing you right onto tape. Careful, Maddie. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. You know, it's 100 people who feel this. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We're like men who have lost their legs, blah, blah, blah. Let's see. Okay. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. You know, when you sit with somebody and you qualify them, and you get them, you really qualify them, but they tell you their story. And we'll again use Christian as an example. You know, I blacked out on the way to India. They wouldn't let me in the country. They turned me around. I ran over the neighbor's yards. I hit their house. I hit their cars. And a simple question: would you think normal people do this? You know, I mean, and if his answer is not no, I don't know what else to ask him. But you need to get them to see, and you need to fully believe that they are real alcoholics, because it I think there's scales of alcoholism, and when you have someone, it's such a joy. For the most part, to work with somebody who is really, 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 really hurt, desperate, and no question, whereas you work with somebody who got a DWI coming home from the country club and got mandated to 3 AA meetings, you know, that's not such a great experience, you know. It's nice to meet them, you know, but... And maybe you'll get a business connection, but it's not a great recovery experience. So, as far as we can say, the real alcoholic is going to believe that in the class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, we will try to prove to themselves exceptions to the rules. And that's the question. Did you try to prove, for years and years and years, you were the exception to the rule? If anyone showing an inability to control his drinking can do a right about face, let him drink like a gentleman. Hats off. You know, heaven knows we have tried hard enough to drink. And then it gives some examples here of all the things, you know, again, they're trying to get the reader to identify that they've probably done the same things we've done. It says here, we do not like to pronounce any individual alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. I guess that's true. I usually have a pretty good opinion. Step over to the nearest barroom, do some controlled drinking, try to drink. I mean, my dad, I shared this. My dad said, you couldn't stop drinking for a week. So I did start drinking for a week. But man, that blackout, that night was when the week was up. It was a stupid experiment. again, I should have just kept drinking. You know, shouldn't have taken that week off.
Wow.
But the best one, I think I shared this, is the Marty Mann. Marty Mann was one of the first women in AA. She was great, but she came out of a nut farm. I think it's Silver Hill in Connecticut. What's it called? Silver Hill? Is that it? You know, she I love the story, and I know I'm taking too much time, but she heard about AA. She She heard about AA. She had a roommate in the Funny Farm named Granny. They wanted to learn about, is it true, you know? And so Marty got a day pass. She went to New York. She met Bill Wilson. He told her about AA. She ran back to, got in by her curfew. And Granny's sitting there waiting in the room going, what'd you see? What'd you see? What, is it real? Did, you know? And she started crying and said, yeah, there's more people like us out there. You know, they're out there and they've got an answer. And it's better to read the book. It's a wonderful story. But anyway, when she got into AA, her test was, you know, here's what you do. You can have two drinks every night, two shots a night, two beers a night, two glasses of wine a night, whatever you want, just two. You know, not three. You know, I guess you could, but you can't save them up and have 14 on Friday. but that this is, if you can do this for 6 months, you're not an alcoholic, you know. And most people would do it for a week and say, look, I did it, you know, for a week. I'm good. And then they go out and celebrate, you know. So these are the things these people tried. You know, there's so much experimentation going on. And Marty Mann was a great character in all of this. There's no way of proving it. We believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. I mean, but it was fun back then, so why would we want to stop? But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have any desire to stop while it's still fun. So here you have the man of 30, you know, and I'm going to, you know, most of us know this story. This is a guy very successful, but he had a drinking problem. He was able to stop for 20 years. And then at retirement, he picked up drinking again, like he should have kept drinking probably the whole time. And it was so bad in retirement that he, you know, checked into all the best rehabs and asylums and was dead within 4 years. It says this story contains a powerful lesson. Young people commencing drink and encourage. Okay. This is very true. It says to be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time nor take the quantities some of us have. And then I don't like this part. It says, because I think it says this is particularly true for women. I think that's a dated statement. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. And I think the women are just as capable as the men. But I do agree with that. I mean, I came to AA. I started drinking at, 17 or something. And I was in AA by 24, my first meeting. I didn't get sober till I was 30 or 31. But it was quick. You know, I knew. And I remember the first guy who told me I was an alcoholic. I was in his house at 6 in the morning. He was my next door neighbor, my parents' next door neighbor, and I was a lifeguard at Nomahegan Swim Club here. And they knew I was always hungover, so they always put me on cleaning the pool at 7 a.m. in the morning. And so I would get up at my parents', go out their back door into the next door because I sold them pot. They were. And so I had a key to there, then I'd go in, I'd do a few bong hits, and I would have a big drink of his. It was terrible, but it's only had VO, you know. It was not my thing. VO. And I guess I made too much noise one morning, and this guy comes in his bathrobe, and he had the 70s mustache. He looked like a porn star, you know. And looking back on it, you know. And they own Smith Cadillac in Elizabeth, and he comes in, he just shakes his head, and he goes, "You're going to be an alcoholic." And I just looked at him and I just said, "Yeah, you're probably right." You know, I was like, "Look who's talking." You know, that was good to hear, but it didn't do anything for me. I was just a blackout. It's not like I drank 7 gallons of vodka a night. I would drink whatever. I just blacked out all the time. Blacked out, and it just bad things happened. Blacked out. It was quick. I'm grateful it was quick. And I started my journey in AA at age 24. So you hear guys with stories of, you know, that's good, but my story was not like that. Certain drinkers would be greatly insulted if they're called alcoholics. I wasn't. They were astonished at I didn't understand it, but it didn't bother me. They're astonished at their inability to stop. We are familiar with the symptoms, see a large number of potential alcoholics. Here's one thing. So you want to know, this is just my own scientific theory, is when you want to spot a potential addict anyway, when you're handing out the Halloween candy, and you're saying, take two, take two, take two. That kid who takes five, he's going to detox, right? That kid you're going to see in detox in about 10 years. Right? Because we're just filling the hole in our soul, right? We're filling the hole in our soul at an early age.
Right.
It's funny, I saw the head of the Westfield schools today. I've done my four-step a lot of times and fifth-step. But one thing I forgot in mind, and it just came to me. When I was in third grade, they had back then what was called Student of the Week. And you come in Monday morning, and you lift your desk, and if you were Student of the Week, there was a little yellow smiley face sticker on the thing. And it came down to the last week, and there was two of us left, me and Craig Bonstein. Funny how I remember his name from third grade, right? And so I got there early. I'd never been to school early. I got there early. And I lifted my desk, and there was no sticker. And I went over to Craig Bonstein's desk, and there it was, you know. And, you know, in my story, I always say that, you know, not that I could tell my mom this and convince her this is what made me an alcoholic, and she could blame it on Wilson School. But, but you know, I did go through the rest of school never, ever trying, because if I don't try and I fail, you don't think I'm stupid, because you can see I'm not trying. I'm out there getting stoned, even in church school. I was always over there at the bridge on Sunday mornings getting stoned. But if I try and I fail, then I look stupid. So I never tried in school and was stupid, but at least I didn't look it. So, but anyway, that was a thing that did affect me.
Shoot.
That thing with, old Craig Bonstein. I bet he's doing great. But anyway, if anyone questions where I'm trying to leave liquor alone, for those unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're assuming the reader wants to stop. Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. It's funny, I have a friend who, actually I might have even been in that class, and there's no way he got the Student of the Week over me, but he stopped drinking, and he never went to AA, never went to AA. Mm-hmm. Yet on Facebook, he would say 24 years, and there'd be a picture of a coin. Mm-hmm. Now, can you get pictures of coin on Facebook? Is there like a library or something? I'm like, well, how does he get in the coin? Does he actually go to one meeting? I mean, I know he didn't, but he is drinking again, and he was on Percocet for his back, of course, but he was on 50 Percocets an hour, but anyway, this is a baffling feature of alcoholism: this utter inability to leave it alone. How shall we help the reader now? Let's see. So here's our first example is a man named Jim. This is one of the most important stories. Jim, I'll read it quickly. This man has a charming wife, family, inherited an automobile agency, a World War record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes Jim. He's an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except the nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35, which is interesting. But in a few years, he became violent and blah, blah, blah. On leaving the asylum, and that is one thing. When you're in a rehab or a detox, don't kid yourself. You are in the loony bin. You know, you are locked up and you are, you know. And you are insane when you're in there, you know. It's when you get to the flight deck commitments and they start arguing with you. And I only did it once and it's not the right thing to do, but I'll just say, you know, could you please raise your right hand and pull your sleeve down, and I'll raise mine, and you'll notice you've got the bracelet on. So, it didn't go over well. So anyway, we told him what we knew about alcohol and made a beginning. But all went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk a half a dozen times in the rapid. Yeah, on each occasion, and he so on each occasion, we worked with them. So they didn't have many people. So six times we would probably say, you know, when you're ready, I'm here. But they kept working with Jim. He agreed he was an alcoholic. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him what happened. He felt irritated at work. He had a few words with the boss. But then he decided to take a drive to the country. He was hungry, so he stopped at a roadside place where they had a bar. No intention of drinking. I thought I'd get a sandwich, and I might find someone to buy a car, as had happened in the past. I sat down at a table. I ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich, so he's having two sandwiches, and another glass of milk. And then this is it, because it's always suddenly. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in the milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. And, you know, I hope you can relate to this. You know, I hope you can relate to the things we thought before this first drink. But the word is suddenly. Suddenly, suddenly, and suddenly, and then we have an insane thought that we believe wholeheartedly. I vaguely sensed that I was not being too smart for taking the whiskey on a full stomach. But it went so well, I ordered another one. I poured it into the milk. I wonder what the bartender was thinking during this. You know, I mean, watching a guy pour around. But it didn't bother me, so I tried another. Thus started one more trip to the asylum, blah, blah, blah. You know, Jim had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. I mean, you could have just had pretzels and probably diluted it the same. But anyway, so you think this is an extreme case, you know, anyway. So I want to go to the next one, the jaywalker I'm going to skip. But I am going to go to Fred. So on page 39, Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. He has a good income, fine home, happily married, promising children. Everything's good for Fred. He's very attractive. Everyone likes him. To all appearances, he's stable, well-balanced individual. Yet, he is alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he recovered from a bad case of jitters. He was ashamed, but far from admitting he was alcoholic. He told himself he had come there to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he thought. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition, and he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him he probably couldn't do that. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, and I think we've all, if we've been involved in this a long time, we meet these kind of people. I told you the one I had. I took him to a meeting, and he said that we were a fine group of people, and he'd like to make a large contribution, but that this wasn't for him. So he made a check out to Dave Hall for $500,000. Much less accept a spiritual remedy of the problem. We told him what we knew of alcoholism. He was interested and conceded he had some of the symptoms, but was a long way from admitting he could do nothing himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober. We did not hear from Fred for a while. One day we heard he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told was most instructive, for here was a guy absolutely convinced that he could stop drinking, that he had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment in everything he did, yet he was flat on his back nonetheless. Let him tell you about it. So he says, I was much impressed with what you fellas said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity, and they're using this word a lot, which precedes the first drink. But I was confident it couldn't happen to me because I was extremely special. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as you losers are, and that I was usually successful in licking my other personal problems that you guys probably couldn't lick, and that I would therefore be successful where you losers failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident because I was a cocky son of a bitch. But it was a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. So in that frame of mind, I went about my business for a time and all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder, this is it, I began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. There's the disease coming right in, just planting the seed, just chipping away, you know. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence for the government. I had been out of town before, no problem. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well because I'm so great. And I was pleased and knew my partners would be too because I was so great. As the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. So there's no triggers for this guy, as we hear in the detoxes all the time. I went to the hotel and dressed leisurely dressed for dinner. So he had no thought while he's up getting dressed here. But as I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it'd be nice to have just a couple cocktails with dinner. That was all. Nothing more. I ordered the cocktail and the meal. Then I ordered another. After drink, I decided to take a walk, right? Because we got to get away from the, you know, we know. But when I returned, the thought came it'd be nice to have a highball and then go to bed. But that's not what happened. I stepped into the bar. I remember having several flights to New York, taxi driver, blah, blah, blah. As soon as I regained my ability, I carefully reviewed the evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. So, I mean, these stories were just trying to identify the various, you know, just bizarre, kooky things we do and believe to get us to take that first drink. This time, the thought had not—I had not thought of the consequences at all. And this is a very, very smart guy, according to this guy. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as the cocktails were ginger ale. I remember how my alcoholic friends told me and prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come. I would drink again. They said the thought, though I did raise a defense, that one day I'd give way for some trivial reason. The two members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I did not like so much. Right? They must have loved that. Then they asked me if I thought I was a real alcoholic, if I was really licked this time. I had to concede to both propositions. They piled heaps of evidence. They cited cases out of their own experiences by the dozen. So then it says, this is a great sentence. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. And that's, so this guy, you can tell, not to say he's an asshole, but, we're all special in a way, and this guy was special. But that's a beautiful, this process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction because I sure thought I could do the job myself. I didn't need or especially want you guys. You know, over there I would sit and just read the pool rules up here. You know, I think this is the worst thing they ever did that's terrible to say. I think it's been harmful to put the steps on the wall just because when idiots like me come in, I'm done with the steps in the first 6 minutes I'm in here. You know, at least I'm done with at least four of them, and that's enough for me, and I'm gone. You know, and the other thing is, you know, we have, you know, how it works. We read the steps, but the short version of the steps, but this is the long version, and we're still here trying to convince you on step one. The last flicker I could do the job myself. Then they outlined the spiritual answer and program of action, which 100 of them had followed successfully. Though I had been only a nominal church member, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. And I think we all thought that when we got here. At least it just didn't make sense. It's so important when you work with somebody to do your best, which is hard, to explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. What's the benefit? What's the objective? As a sponsor, what your experience has been with it, and that you were scared shitless to do a four-step, but it's, you know, you really try to make it make sense to the newcomer. But the program of act in time is pretty drastic. I meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. That was not easy. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual, this is coming from this jerk off. It says, quite as important was the discovery, and I think they try to paint him as a jerk off so that you can say, if this guy can go along with it, discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. I have since been brought, and this is true and this is great. It says, I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the life I had lived before. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back even if I could. Boy, that's a fast clock, isn't it? And that's, that's the thing, because you do see, and I think I keep repeating myself, hopefully. You do hear every year that, some drug companies come up with a drug that'll make us drink like normal people, And there's always a disclaimer at the bottom, though, saying, except for the real alcoholic. But, I think part of the spiritual awakening maybe is that when you hear that, you really have no desire to take that pill because the life you've been given and helping others is so wonderful that, that you see things so differently, you have no interest in taking that pill. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home for thousands of assholes like him. And Bill Wilson wrote this. He had felt only the nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they can really commence to solve their problems. And that's we have a lot of nip of the ringer people. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree. At the bottom. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor these nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Wow, that's unbelievable.
I
assumed I had like four more pages to go. I'm trying to find a good way to a good place to stop, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.